thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
There we go.
Here's John Williams.
That's what we do, 24-7. You notice I paused before the 7 part. Hi, it's John. It's 109. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here weekdays from 1 to 3. We're glad that you are, too. You can hear me Saturdays from 10 a.m. till noon. We do a swell podcast I think you'll like. It's called The Mincing Rascals. Wherever you download, find our podcast, listen for The Mincing Rascals. Last week, The Mincing Rascals minced on the possibility of a pardon for former Governor Rod Blagojevich. It's a sentence commutation. I keep saying pardon. Those are two different things, and who knows what the president has up his sleeve. But today we learned that the president and the White House are preparing documents for as many as 30 grants of clemency. I reached out to the Department of Justice. They have an Office of the Pardon Attorney, which is the office in the federal government that exists specifically to advise the president on things like this. Doesn't have to take their advice. You can imagine how dismissive Trump might be of some bureaucracy that he doesn't fully know or care about. He goes by his gut, right? But they do have guidelines for which these sorts of things are done. And one of them is contrition, that the office would be more inclined to recommend to the president that somebody be granted some measure of clemency if the person is contrite. That is not what you read in the Wall Street Journal recently. If there's any movement on that story in the next couple of hours until 3, and then afterwards with Ro and Anna, you know that we will be on it here. In the meantime, page 1 of the Chicago Tribune every day this week, starting Sunday and digitally on Saturday, it seems, has been the story Betrayed, how the Chicago schools have been failing to protect students from sexual abuse. I think John Cass was right. I noticed Heidi Stevens liked John Cass's tweet today when he said that this is our version of what the Catholic Church went through with the priest abuse sex scandal. And you know what I was thinking of, though, as this story is unfolding, is I didn't immediately go there as much as I went to the abuse that the Olympic athletes had to endure over and over and over again, that it was systemic and that there seemed to be no remedy and that those that would speak out would sort of be put aside or themselves be accused. Those very same themes have been playing out in a series of stories done by a series of reporters at the Tribune. One of them's in our studio, David Jackson, an investigative reporter at the Tribune. Hi, David. How are you?
John, thank you.
What do you make of that analysis?
I agree. The culture of silence is part of what allows this abuse to go on and on and on for years and to claim so many lives.
What's been happening at the Chicago Public Schools?
Well, we found more than 500 police reports of sexual violence against students during the last decade. These are cases that range from outright violent rapes of students by educators to creepy, groping hugs that are sexualized. And we found that the Chicago Public Schools finally coughed up when we threatened to sue for basic data. Figures showing that they have, since 2011, investigated 430 of their workers for sexual abuse, assault, or harassment against students.
430 instances or 430 members of the staff?
430 instances. Thanks. Good point, John. And they found credible evidence in more than half of those, 230. So it's kind of a stunning frequency. John, if you'd asked me at the beginning of our investigation, well, David, how many cases do you guys think are out there? I would have said, John, there might be dozens. I never would have said to you, John, I think there's hundreds.
Especially in such a short, relatively speaking, time frame. Are you including student-on-student sexual assault?
I am. And in order to kind of parse out student-on-student from educator-on-student, we did a close examination of 108 cases where we'd identified pretty much all the case details. And out of those 108, John, 72 were educators and the others were student-on-student cases.
I'm sorry. So these numbers we're talking about, 430 and 500-plus, those include students assault? Students?
They do.
That makes the number more imaginable to me just because of the age range and because of the what I perceive to be sometimes undisciplined and violent nature of some of these kids and some of these schools. None of this is settling, but what's more outrageous to you, the total number or the number of instances where adults are preying on the kids?
Definitely the number of instances where we have adults here. I mean, these are more than just cases of sexual violence against young people. They are a complete betrayal of a pact of trust every parent makes when they send their son or daughter off to school in the morning. These are, this should be the second safest place for a young person after their home. And instead, we found, John, failed background checks of school workers. We found a complete disregard of the state laws about reporting these cases. And again, just to go to your very first point, we found a wall of secrecy surrounding this, and we really had to dig to get it out.
What sent you down this road? What was your first tip?
It wasn't really a tip. We get these, and we publish in the Tribune periodically, these mugshots of disgraced educators as they one by one get charged with a crime. And we always, you know, every one of us always says, well, what a monster, what a terrible thing happened, and thank goodness they caught that person. And we had never, and I've never seen a big city newspaper do it, sort of step back and take in a comprehensive look at how frequent is this, what is the scope of this, and why is it happening. And it was an investigative project in which the story subject was hiding right there in plain sight.
How long have you been working on this?
We started in January, and the Trib really threw kind of a dream team on it once we started to see what was there. It involved Jennifer Smith Richards, who's a veteran education reporter and database specialist, Gary Marks, who's a former foreign correspondent who's done tours of duty in Iraq and North Africa and everywhere else, and Juan Perez Jr., he's the Tribune's education beat writer.
Was it difficult to get the victims to come forward?
When we talk to victims, John, what we do is we put all the power in their hands in terms of doing these interviews. We don't come up to them and say, we would love to put your story on the record. We come up to them and tell them exactly what we're doing, try to be as transparent as possible, and ask them if they want to help us. And frankly, if people say, well, I'll tell you my story, but I don't want to be named, we say, that's fine, thank you. That's still an education for us. So it's really a matter of being very transparent and putting the power in the hands of these young people. And John, at the end of the day, I was blown away by the bravery, I guess the kind of unintimidated nature of some of these young people as they described events that we then tried to corroborate, or did corroborate, through police reports, government records, confidential memos, that sort of thing.
Give me a representative narrative.
We talked to a young person from Peyton High School, the elite selective enrollment school, one of the top high schools in the United States, who had reported that she had been kissed and then touched on the thigh by a teacher. And she recounted to us her account. Her name is Morgan Aranda, of trying to get attention, trying to get her report made, trying to seek justice in this case. It was in a way, the effort that she made was more of a betrayal than the original touch and kiss. And
wait a minute, why do you say that?
Well, because what happened to Morgan when she disclosed all of this to her English teacher at Peyton was that instead of doing what the law requires here in Illinois and picking up the phone and calling state child welfare investigators, that teacher decided to bring Morgan to an assistant principal. Morgan then was subjected to a round robin of interviews. She had to write out a statement. She was then interviewed by the Chicago Public Schools Law Department, and every single discrepancy in the semantics of her accounts, every word change, was it a tap on your leg or a squeeze?
Did she have an attorney with her at these times?
She did not even have her mom, and that was one of the other outrageous things. She was be called out of class and talked to by a new stranger in an
so
office.
So she's assaulted to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
harassed, at least, she reaches out to a teacher, and then she endures this.
Exactly. And this is a – Morgan was a extremely bright young woman. She represented Illinois in the National History Contest. And as an eighth grader, she had a resolution introduced to honor her for that by Representative Mike Quigley. She was on her way, she thought, to a
– What happened in this case?
Oh, she was subjected to interview after interview, and finally, after more than a year, the teacher was essentially dismissed, but he resigned during that process, kept his pension, and Morgan's trust in teachers was completely destroyed.
In some of these cases, then, the teacher then goes on to teach somewhere else, and they don't forewarn the next school district, do they?
We told the story of Stephen Stepanian, a teacher in the Montefiore School for Disabled Youth, who was alleged to have groped the crotch of a student and also to have taught other students how to access pornography on the school computers. In 2011, a Chicago Public Schools investigation corroborated and found credible evidence that it happened. Mr. Stepanian resigned and simply moved to Florida and started teaching in Florida. The report that found credible evidence that he'd done this was kept completely secret. It was under wraps. There was no public mention of this. Florida knew nothing about it until we dug it out.
Is the teachers' union involved in one side or the other of this?
Well, in Morgan's case, for example, the teachers' union did end up being part of the questioning of her at an administrative hearing for the license of that teacher. And she felt, and you read the transcript and you see, she was really attacked when she tried to
How old is she during this process? 16?
She was 14 years old. She was a freshman.
Hmm. Are there new allegations or possible convictions stemming from the Tribune investigation?
There's a whole bunch of change coming on.
I mean, we have these numbers here in the 400s and 500s, but that's what's been reported so far. Are you hearing about new cases?
We did establish a tip box on the online, and people have been calling in stories. We're investigating those, but I think, John, the other really big change is both at Chicago Public Schools and in the State General Assembly, there are some really strong movements for reform in the wake of these revelations.
I want to know what you think about the mayor's response to this and the acting school's chief in just a minute. It's 122. We're talking about the Betrayed series, which is page one in the Chicago Tribune today and every day this week. I presume tomorrow as well, another story along these lines.
Yeah, tomorrow, Friday, and Sunday.
What a shame that there's sufficient fodder for this now series. David Jackson's in our studio. This is WGN. In our studio is David Jackson, one of a team of reporters at the Chicago Tribune. Their Betrayed series is every day now been talking about instances of sexual abuse of students in the Chicago public school system by teachers, administrators, and students. It's shocking. The mayor has said he's sorry about what's happened. What's his role in all of this?
He owns it, basically. The mayor is facing a barrage of criticism from other mayoral candidates and from other civic leaders on this issue, not just because of the big fail here on sexual violence against students, but because of a litany of problems that have raked the Chicago public schools.
Do you think the mayor knew or should have known about this problem?
Definitely the mayor should have known.
Did he?
I don't know if he did or not, but I do know that this is a problem that was, you know, we called out from records of the police, which he's in charge of, and of the Chicago public schools.
So do you think this is going to resonate in the election?
I think it's certainly been an issue yesterday. All of the or several of the candidates for mayor weighed in on this. Emmanuel, as you point out, answered by saying he's apologizing. And the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, Janice Jackson, has been constantly out there on radio, in meetings, in public forums talking about this.
Yeah. Where does this story go next?
Well, I think, you know, we sort of pivot in a sense as investigative reporters from digging to continuing to dig, but also holding accountable the top officials for the promises of reform that they're making. You talked about student on student violence versus teacher on student violence, and the first kind of installments or chapters that we got out there, John, were all about teachers. We're definitely turning to a very, very close look now at the phenomenon of student on student sexual violence in Chicago schools.
Is there going to be civil recourse for these victims?
A couple of the victims have filed suit, a couple of the victims that we wrote about. We'll be writing about that in Friday's paper. And I think that the brave young men and women who spoke out in our series, I think, can claim, you know, that they've really heralded change, and they can feel an enormous sense of bringing justice here for others.
Let's talk next week, David. Nice job over there.
Thank you. Great to be here, John.
It's kind of an understatement on my part. You know, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper, the Chicago Tribune investigative team, and their series Betrayed. One of the reporters is David Jackson. David, thank you. It's 129. The news is next on WGN.
Women in Saudi Arabia, the first woman was granted a license to be able to drive a car. They also need women to teach the women to drive, because you need a woman to do that there.
And yeah, I can't have a man do it.
Violetta, I think this is a real opportunity for you.
Yeah.
The traffic queen of Saudi Arabia, Violetta Podramatic.
And they pay. That gig probably pays $500,000 a year.
Right. Yeah. Pay you in solid brick gold.
Or barrels of oil.
Enough said. I'm there.
Yeah. Does this thing work? Uh-oh!
You're doing fine. Faster.
The Ro Khan Show with Anna Devlantis, this afternoon at 3 on 720 WGN.
You're late for work and still have to drop off the kids at school. You jump in your car, hit the garage door remote, and nothing happens. Now what?
Green Tea Services, service to a green tea.
Hi, it's Tonya Khoury for my family business, Green Tea Services. Right now, we have a garage door maintenance special. Our trained technicians come out and adjust the springs, check the cables, inspect the rollers, tighten hinges, and give your door and opener a complete lubrication. All for just $47.
Service to a green tea.
Garage doors fail when you least expect it. Don't get stuck in or out of your garage. Call for our $47 garage door maintenance special. Call Green Tea now for details. 800-5-GREEN-TEA.
Green Tea Services, service to a green tea. 800-5-GREEN-TEA.
800-5-GREEN-TEA or greenteaservices.com.
Some of life's great joys come simply, don't they? A walk in the garden, playing catch with the kids, setting the world pogo stick record. I'm sorry, that makes me laugh. But you can't do any of those things because your knee is bothering you. Well, you may know where this is going, right? This is another ad for the Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park, because it works. I'm John Williams. It's where I went for my knee pain. Look, your knee pain can be a thing of the past. And I think what happens too often is you get stubborn. You say, oh, well, I'm fine. This is just the way it is. I'm older than I used to be. It does not have to be that way. You owe it to yourself. This is a quick, non-surgical, pain-free procedure. You're in and you're out, and after a series of treatments, lo and behold, you're able to sleep better, get in and out of the car, or maybe go for that walk pain-free. Maybe walk a little farther or chase the grandkids a little faster. They do this at the Joint Relief Institute. They use advanced digital technology. They see where your knee is failing you. They put a joint lubricant into that spot. Their care, expertise, and the technology make a difference. Here's a number to call. 708-888-0000. 708, that's Orland Park. 888, think ache, ache, ache. 0000, as in zero pain. Okay, 732. Time for the news, sponsored by OralScreeningTest.com. This is Kim Gordon.
Amazon Go has picked two downtown locations for their cashierless store in Chicago, Ogilvie Transportation Center and the Willis Tower. Customers will be able to check out using their smartphones to quickly buy food. No word on when the stores will open. President Trump has commuted the sentence of a woman whose case was championed by reality star Kim Kardashian West, saying she's been a model inmate. 63-year-old Alice Marie Johnson has served more than two decades in federal prison for drug offenses. A woman convicted of fatally beating her son on his fourth birthday is set to be sentenced today. Crystal Valdez was convicted by a Cook County jury of first-degree murder. The 35-year-old faces up to 60 years in prison. Your money, sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
This is your White Sox Minute. I'm Jason Benetti.
The Sox split their doubleheader yesterday against Minnesota and held late leads in both games, thanks in large part to the starting pitching, and young starting pitching at that. Reynaldo Lopez and Lucas Giolito combined for 13 innings on the mound to start the games. Two earned runs combined. Lopez threw seven shutout innings in game number one. It's the first time since August 2nd of 1990 at Milwaukee the Sox had two pitchers under age 25 and a twin bill go six innings or more and two runs or fewer allowed. Alex Fernandez and Melito Perez that day. It was Alex Fernandez and Frank Thomas's major league debuts that day. Join us every Wednesday home game for Dollar Hot Dog Wednesdays presented by Securian Financial. The next one is 1 week away as the Sox take on the Indians at 7:10 p.m. Visit whitesox.com/dollardogs for tickets. This has been your White Sox Minute.
Have you noticed everything has a day? Like National Hot Dog Day. Best with pickles, onions, and absolutely no ketchup. But AARP in Chicago thinks today should be your day. So go explore the neighborhoods. We're working with you to improve transportation and create safer streets. And get family caregiving resources. We're advocating for you and your loved ones. We're here in our community helping you make the most of it. So grab a Chicago dog and take on today and every day with AARP. Learn how at aarp.org/Chicago.
Policies issued by American General Life Insurance Company, Houston, Texas. Not available in all states. For details, visit AIGDirect.com.
It takes a lot of courage to face your own death, but I'm glad I finally did. See, I was putting off getting life insurance to protect my family, even though I knew it was important. Then my neighbor's husband died. I watched her struggle emotionally and financially. It really made me face reality. If my husband died, how would I pay the mortgage, the car payments, or keep up the life the kids and I had? I realized I needed to get us life insurance right away. So I called AIG Direct. In less than 5 minutes, I had a quote. I was shocked at how affordable it is. Just $14 a month for $250,000 of term life coverage. I feel so much better knowing my family has protection.
Call AIG Direct right now for a free no-obligation quote. The call takes less than 5 minutes, and you can save up to 70%. Call now, 1-800-900-5338. That's 1-800-900-5338. 1-800-900-5338.
Your money on WGN. The Dow's up 241 points. NASDAQ up 31. The S&P 500 up 14. Prices at the Mercantile Exchange, the nearby cattle contract, as well as the hog contract, both trading up this hour. Trends in today's grain trade. Wheat's up 12. Corn down 4 3/4. Soybeans down 6.5. We'll have grain settlements an hour from now. WGN Sports. The White Sox visit Minnesota tonight. The pregame with Andy Mazur, 6:35. First pitch, 7:10 with Ed Farmer and Darren Jackson on 720 WGN. The Cubs continue their series against Philadelphia. The NBA Finals tonight. Golden State is at Cleveland. WGN Traffic, Violetta Podramedic.
Traffic is sponsored by Indeed, and travel times are starting to build. Inbound Edens, 25 minutes Lake Hook Road to the Junction, 16 minutes out. The Kennedy's almost 50 minutes O'Hare to downtown, 38 minutes outbound. Outbound side of the Stevenson, worse off at over an hour from the old post office to 390, 50 minutes back in. The Stevenson's about 45 minutes either way between Lakeshore Drive and 355. And then if you're headed in on the Dan Ryan, it's 25 minutes 95th to the Circle, still clear outbound at just 17 minutes. Are you high? Hiring with Indeed, you can post the job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates on your online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/hire. For personalized traffic on demand, get the Traffic Chicago app. Approved by the mortgage experts of Team Hochberg. Just search TRAFFIX Chicago. I'm Violetta Podrumetic in WGN Traffic Central.
The WGN Chicago Weather Center forecast, partly to mostly sunny skies today, mild, pleasant, a high of 77. Tonight, partly cloudy, scattered showers, a thunderstorm possible late, a low of 63. Tomorrow, partly to mostly cloudy, scattered showers, thunderstorms possible again with a high of 79, but a little bit cooler near the lake. Right now, O'Hare 66, Midway 70, Lockport 68, along the lakefront 61. I'm Kim Gordon in the WGN Radio Newsroom, and this is the stuff that matters on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Darn right, Kim, this is the stuff that matters. We're talking about 40-some-odd new or just about to be new opening restaurants, bars, bistros, and pubs in Chicago with Phil Vitale. You go out now and again, right? You guys eat out a little bit in the city.
Oh, I love Chicago restaurants. Are you kidding? And every time there's a new one, I can't wait to try it.
You've got one that you're loving especially right now?
Oh, boy. I love Monteverde. I know it's not that new, but I do love Monteverde.
Monteverde.
It's in the West Loop. The chef won a James Beard Award for Best Restaurant last year, maybe?
She was Best Chef Great Lakes last year. Yeah.
It's kind of pricey.
No.
It's not terrible. No, it's not.
No, pasta specialist Sarah Grunenberg was the executive chef at Spiaggia for a number of years, and then she opened her own place west of the Loop.
This is Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. He joins us now and again. And where is this happy happening place that we're talking about?
Is it on Washington or Madison Street? I get mixed up. But it's west of the expressway by a little bit. And it's a very cool place.
This is a pretty ambitious what you put in the paper today, my friend.
Thank
44 you. Summer eating list. 44 new and upcoming Chicago restaurants, from must-goes to field trips. You do this every summer, huh?
I do this every summer. I was inspired by those summer reading lists the teachers always gave you at the end of the year. And this is what you said. So I decided, I'll make it a summer eating list. And here's my assignment to the general public. You should be prepared come September to discuss many of these. I've got my required eatings. I've got my electives. I've got my extra credits. The field trips is just because I couldn't think of another word to describe places that are a little more far flung. So, in the school term kind of thing, I called them field trips.
Okay, so in the required, and then you list them alphabetically, not necessarily one's better than another.
Mm-mm.
But we've got about 12 of them here, more than that. What are the highlights in the required? Eating new in Chicago?
Well, I've got high hopes for ABBA, which is the first one on the list. That is the sequel to Ema. And if you knew that restaurant Ema was based on the Hebrew word for mother, then the fact that his sequel restaurant is the Hebrew word for father is not surprising.
Got it.
But that's what he's doing out in the Fulton Market District. That's CJ Jacobson, who I like to refer to as the world's tallest chef, which probably isn't accurate, but he played pro volleyball for a while.
And no kidding. He's actually a tall dude.
Oh, yes. He's a tall guy.
And is Fulton the place where the restaurants are right now? Is that the hot spot?
It is hot. Oh, yeah, everything, a lot of stuff going out further west, too, but Fulton Market's gotten to the point that the rents are exceeding River North. You can actually save money by putting your restaurant in River North these days, which is nuts.
What kind of cuisine, then? Is it Mediterranean at ABBA?
Yeah, he's very Mediterranean. He's going to have, I think, a little more meat at ABBA than he did there, probably because of the kind of clientele he's likely to get there. But it's going to be, I think, a lot of the same kind of Mediterranean, lighter, probably pretty healthy overall, although you'll eat enough of it that you won't feel like you're eating healthy.
What about Etta?
That's the sequel. That's Maple and Ash is one of my favorite steakhouses in the city. It's in the Gold Coast. And the chef there, Danny Grant, is opening with the principals behind the first restaurant, a place out on North Avenue, which was for many years home to The Southern, which is right there on North Avenue. They gutted it. They took it down to the rubble and rebuilt the whole thing. And, I'll be real interested to see what exactly they do there. But he's trying to posit it as the kind of food you just feel like eating on a Wednesday or something like that. It's going to keep it real simple. I think there's going to be an aggressive carryout program. And, it's what he calls his idea of neighborhood food. And he lives, I think, a few blocks away. So
easy for him.
He's living it, right.
Free Rein is on your list. Funkenhausen, which you might think is Austrian or Bavarian or German kind of food and beer.
Or something to do with Parliament, that funk band. But it's a great name, Funkenhausen.
Yeah, no kidding. I want to go there, and I don't know anything about it. But it's a German joint?
It's a little German. I mean, Mark Steuer grew up in the South. But with the name Steuer, he has German heritage. So this is his way of melding the two. We would have called it fusion cooking way back when, but that's become a dirty word, so we don't call it that. But he's going to be taking some of the food of his people and putting doing the way he interprets.
1709 West Chicago Avenue. So how far west is that? Is that downtown? Is that in the Loop?
Well, 1600 west is Ashland, so 17 is going to be two blocks west.
A little bit
of
further
that.
West than where we are right now, anyway.
Yeah, I can't walk it.
Gibson's Italia, Good Fortune, Kumiko?
Kumiko.
Yeah. Le Sud, which I presume is a French place.
Mm-hmm.
Mordecai, we've talked about before. That are you talking about the one over at the Hotel Zachary?
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, over by across the street from Wrigley Field on
one
Clark.
Of like five restaurants in that hotel.
I count six depending on how you do it, because they do have a kind of bakery brew house.
Oh, right. Westtown Bakery's out there. Yep.
Yeah,
I
right.
keep forgetting them, and I shouldn't.
If you include, and by the way, you also included the Doc and Dutch's place,
right.
which is the new one at the very corner of Clark and Addison.
Right.
You haven't eaten there yet, have
no,
you?
No, and it was funny. Last time I was at Mordecai, they were having a press party at Dutch and Doc's, so I could have tried to talk my way in, maybe, but nah. But Dutch and Doc's is the only place you can't access directly from the hotel, even though it's still part of the same one building. But otherwise, yeah, that one is going to be closely related to their other concept that group has, which is Swift & Sons out on the Fulton Market District. It's their steakhouse. I think it's the same chef. And I think a lot of the menu items, there'll be a lot of carryover in the menu items, but it's going to be a different look, and it's big, and it's got two floors. And from the second floor especially, you sit there at the table, and the Wrigley Field marquee is right there in front of you, right through the window.
Yeah. So I've been there twice.
I hesitate
to say how much I like it, because I don't want anybody to go there.
Right. You went back. You went twice out of being polite the second time, right?
Really? I mean, is it? If a radio guy using his own money
Holy
goes a second
smokes.
Time, then that's quite the endorsement.
Uh-huh.
And we like the room, we like the view, and we've enjoyed the food and beverages there. So I have mm-hmm. not had I will be there a third time, but that's for sure.
All right.
And that's, by the way, do you know why they call it Doc and Dutch?
Yes, because those are the two most common nicknames in Major League Baseball history. And something like 14 Cubs have been named Dutch over the years.
It's the number one nickname for Cubs players, too.
And that's not even counting Dutch Reagan, Ronald Reagan, that was his nickname.
Oh, that's right.
And he was a Cubs announcer for about 2 years way back when. But he wasn't a player, so he's like the extra Dutch or something like that.
Twain is on your list.
Yes, I've been looking forward. We've been looking forward to this for 2 years. Tim Graham was at True, and then he was at Travel, which is the restaurant in the old IBM building, now the AMA building. And he broke off. He's doing his own thing with his wife and wine and beverage expert Rebecca, and they were hoping to get something going last year. It didn't quite work out. You know, you're building your first restaurant from scratch. It always takes four times longer than you think it's going to take. And now they're getting very close, hoping late summer to open Twain, which refers to Mark Twain and Chef Tim Graham's Missouri roots.
So what would a Twainian, I mean, that restaurant conjures up Missouri or
right.
the heartland. What kind of food does that mean?
He says he's going to be doing spinoffs from vintage cookbooks that he's acquired, some things dating back to the 40s and 50s and 60s.
I'm looking for a catfish on this menu.
You know, Tim is a pretty precise, technique-driven guy. So there might be catfish on the menu, but when it hits the plate, you're going to go, wait a minute, this is not a pecan fried catfish. What is this?
Right.
It might be standing up. It might be doing something else. But it's not going to be, I shouldn't say it's not, because we're at least 8 weeks away from opening, but I don't expect a real traditional look to this place.
So it's a 146 on WGN. Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune's in our studio. You can see in print today and online, of course, as well. Summer eating list, 44 new and upcoming Chicago restaurants from must-goes to field trips. So those are some of the required readings or eatings mm-hmm. in your case. The electives include Dutch and Doc's, Cafe Bohème, Bonhomme.
Yeah, Bonhomme.
Flight Club. I like the sound of that. This mm-hmm. is the first USA location for this restaurant bar darts concept, which originated in England. Flight Club features, I'm just reading you now, mm-hmm. aren't I? A menu by executive chef Rick Gresh, who offers an extensive lineup with a raw bar on the main level and more casual light bites on the second floor on West Wacker Drive, so downtown.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. You always get a little like, when you hear about a concept coming from any other city, much less overseas. But Rick Gresh has been cooking in Chicago for 20 years, I want to say. So he knows the market, and the food will work. And I don't play darts, but for all I know, people love the whole dartsy thing, and it'll be a hit.
Okay, but you understand that I'm a little apprehensive about going to a place that serves cocktails and darts.
Yeah.
I hope they've
alcohol segregated. And sharp implements. That's what could possibly go wrong there?
So this is the electives category. Give me another one that you're excited
don't wear
about.
Don't wear that giveaway shirt from Target, by the way,
when you
go there.
Give me another one in the elective category
I am looking forward
in.
To, I say looking forward to going because it's already open, is Locanda, which is in the Marriott Residence Inn on Walton Street. And this is the latest restaurant from Antoine Sidici, and people who have a certain age will remember Panicaldo in the Gold Coast and his Trattoria Ultimo, and now he's back, and he does wonderful luxury level Italian food. I haven't been in, so I don't know if this is going to be a little more sedate than Panicaldo was, since it's inside a Marriott Residence Inn. I'm going to guess it will be.
Yeah,
but he's always put together solid restaurants, and he knows Italian cooking inside out. So.
One more, just I'm going to skip to mm-hmm. in your electives category, the last one, Z-Bar, because it's got one word in there that I always like to see, and that's rooftop. It's a rooftop right. bar on the Peninsula Hotel, Chicago Hotel 6th floor, you wrote, and then you write right. a little bit about the bold bites and the tables for a room for about 50 outside. Are there places on this that you think are especially good for dining al fresco or the rooftop scene?
You know, you almost have to. So I think this one's going to be good. They were the Peninsula already has a couple of. They already have the terrace outside their Shanghai Terrace restaurant, which is two floors below where Z Bar is going to be. They're really going all out with the Z Bar thing. They're spending a lot of money on the interiors. They know that it's a fleeting season, the summer in Chicago for wow. outdoor terraces and. And even when the weather's right, it could be raining like it is right now.
Is it raining? Holy cow, it's raining downtown Chicago. I just turned and looked out the Showcase studio window.
Yeah, I think it's just stopped, actually.
Yeah, it did.
The umbrellas are back folded. But, yeah, so if you were having lunch right now, you'd be running for cover. So, so they're putting a lot of money in. This is going to have its own dedicated elevator from the lobby level this way to Z-Bar. And you go, and the elevators are going to be all decorated funny. And it's all going to supposedly sweep you into a whole other kind of environment.
Hotel Peninsula. It's 149. Phil Vitale's here. We'll pause. You've got a question, comment, an observation. This is your chance. 312-981-7200. Call or text right now. I see some calls already waiting. You can be one of them. 312-981-7200. Call or text, and Phil will take you next on WGN. Phil, here's a text. Phil Vitale, restaurant critic, Chicago Tribune. Any updates on Ed DeBevick's?
None that I've heard. As a lot of us know, Ed DeBevick's closed last year when the property was sold to a developer, and can't wait to see what kind of funky things going up there. But, of course, it'll be another big building. And on their website, they teased out the idea that Ed's might rise again.
But there is no Ed DeBevick's in Chicago now?
There is no Ed DeBevick's. I don't think there's an Ed DeBevick's anywhere.
Do you think the time has changed and maybe there isn't room? Look, I have enough snark in my world. I don't need the waiters and waitresses, and they're funny, and it's a concept, mm-hmm. but I wonder if the concept is past.
Well, it's an interesting point. You know, there's still the hot dog place in DePaul where they'll yell at you, so it's not completely gone. I think they just need the right kind of space. They need a place that's big enough because people go to Ed DeBevick's. It's really a party of two, right? It's 6, 8, and you get to banter and you yell back and forth to the waiters. And if you get it and you're into it, you can have fun with it.
Yeah.
It's like going into a comedy club where they expect you to heckle the guy a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
And then you find out that they're way ahead of you and they're better.
Yeah, but I'm going to quote somebody I know who's pretty funny, and he said, "Hey, if I wanted that, I'd go on Facebook." In fact,
yeah.
It was you. You said that
just
a short while ago.
Yeah, if I want nonstop abuse, I'll go on Facebook and type something like, "I stand with Roseanne." Yeah, that'll get me. that'll give me a comment or three.
Okay, so no Ed DeBevick's right now, no news, although it may yet happen. What does Phil think about Bevette's? Boy, we get a comment or a question about Bevette's every week.
It's a very, very good steakhouse. I love real good steaks, real good food. I love the atmosphere. I love the fact that this is a restaurant that plays jazz, a steakhouse that plays jazz, whereas I think everybody who opens a steakhouse gets the Frank Sinatra Spotify account, and they just play Sinatra nonstop, and they're playing really cool music. And it's, Brendan Sadikoff has just everything he touches seems to turn to gold. And this one's particularly a big hit.
This is Bevette's we're talking about. Mm-hmm. This is a nice note. She says, I want to take my boyfriend there as a retirement dinner. He spent just under 50 years working in the steel mills. He deserves a good steak dinner.
Wow.
So Bevette's is a pack. It's my wife's been there a few times with friends and says it's just dynamite. I've never been there. If you didn't go to Bevette's but you wanted to go somewhere for a celebratory steak dinner, where would you go?
These days, well, I love Maple and Ash because it's so glitzy and all the rest of it. I also love Gibson's Italia because of the wide windows that overlook the Chicago River going east on the Chicago River, and it's just stunning.
And that is on your list of 40-some new restaurants in Chicago,
right,
too.
Right. I kind of cheated on them because they just opened their rooftop. They actually opened late last year, but I included them in this list because the rooftop is having its first summer.
Jerry has a question for you. And she's not on that line. She's on this
something
one.
Something I said?
No, nope. Jerry, although you're not going to like this. Hey, Jerry, you're on the air.
Am I on now?
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Thanks, John. I am a great reader of the Tribune, and I do value Phil's opinions.
Thank you.
Why is it that his 44 restaurants, there is nothing south of the South Loop or in closer than the far western suburbs? I live by Midway Airport. Do we not deserve to have good restaurants, good food? Maybe if we did, people would patronize them more.
What a great point. I'll let him respond. I've got about 27 seconds.
All right. These are all new restaurants. I've been doing this for more than 5 years, and I set out messages to everyone saying, let me know if there's anything new. If you know of something new in that neighborhood, happy to include it. But if you look at my list, I go all the way out to Barrington. I go all the way south to Crown Point. I've got a Crown Point, Indiana restaurant in here. I'm beating the bushes, honest. I'm doing
so. This
isn't
you beating up on the south side. This is a list of new places in the Chicago area, and evidently no hot new places are opening up over by Midway.
And I groveling apologies if I'm missing out on something. But if somebody's, you know, if you eat something, say something. You know, let me know. my doors and at least my email are always open.
How do people reach you, Phil?
Well, you can always try pvittel at chicagotribune.com. You can go to my Facebook page where I'm just Phil Vittel, or this works occasionally, shine the silhouette of a bat against the night sky, and I will reply.
Let's talk again next Wednesday, my friend. It's a pleasure to see and read you.
Always fun. Thank you.
In the Tribune today, in print and online. He's got a bunch of recommendations for you this summer.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Yeah, here I am. Now it's sunny. It was rainy moments ago. Now I see blue skies, white puffy clouds, actually white thin clouds. Look at me. I'm doing play-by-play of the sky, but it's a lovely day downtown Chicago. 20 minutes ago, it wasn't. It'll change again in a little while, I suppose. It's 2:10. We're in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. I'm WGN King John on social media. Like me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and remember, we do a podcast on Thursdays here we think's pretty good, and it's called The Mincing Rascals. So if you like this show, I know you'll like The Mincing Rascals. Subscribe to that. It's free wherever you listen to your finer podcasts. Litfest is around the corner. The Tribune's sure been pushing that, haven't they? But it's a great event in the city, and it brings journalists, it brings writers of all stripes, novelists, writers of nonfiction, all into one place, and then they do readings and interviews and talk sessions, and you buy books and mill about. It's just one of the great things of the summer in the city. And we've been featuring some of the artists on this show. Linda Gartz is one of them, a Chicagoan who's written a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. Her book is called Redlined, and she's in our studio. Linda, nice to meet you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
People know your work in Chicago. You've worked in television for Channel 2, for Channel 11. You are a documentarian and a writer and a reporter and an educator.
Yes, that's all true.
So now you've been pushing, listen to me. You didn't use that word, did you?
No.
You've been promoting Redlined, which is a book you've written about really your family experience growing up on Washington Street in
Correct.
Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
What a great story.
Thank you.
And so well told. And I didn't know, maybe I did, but I didn't really know sort of the history of that phrase, redlined.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us where that came from.
Okay. Well, back in 1933, the Roosevelt administration, in the heart of the Depression, decided they wanted to make loans more available to people. So they started the FHA and they started the Homeowners Loan Corporation. Homeowners Loan Corporation, often known as HOLC, H-O-L-C, asked real estate agents and banks around the country to map neighborhoods based upon which neighborhoods were safe for loans. And they did this with a color coding map. And you can actually find samples of these maps of all many, many hundreds of places in Chicago, in the country, by going to mapping inequality. But what they did is they gave the color green to those neighborhoods that were very safe for loans, blue, pretty safe. Good. Yellow meant definitely declining, not so great. But red meant no loans were available at all. So they would literally either color the area in a red or draw a red line around it. And the thing that is significant about that is it wasn't just that the housing stock may be bad, but if one African-American person moved into that neighborhood, then that neighborhood was redlined. And so that really deprived African-Americans for all those years forever of investing in property.
So you describe what it was like when a black family would move into the neighborhood. And racism may have been part of it. You don't want blacks moving into your white neighborhood because it's a white neighborhood and you're somehow threatened by that. But it was true, evidently, that if blacks started to move into the neighborhood, then you would find it difficult to get a home loan to buy in that neighborhood, or a home improvement loan would be difficult to get.
Exactly. And I think that is one of the reasons why a lot of, and certainly this is true of my family, pardon me, if you drove through African-American neighborhoods, they always looked very dilapidated. But when you think about it, if you wanted to get a loan to, let's say, fix your sagging porch, you couldn't get a home owner's loan. You couldn't get a home equity loan.
This is such a key point, and you make it early in the book, and I'm so glad you did, from a very personal perspective, too, because there'd be members of your family or friends going, boy, the black neighborhood, black has moved into the neighborhood. What are we going to do about that? Literally, fence post type conversation. And you say it was true, but not for the reasons that we might think. That is, the neighborhood may go downhill, not because black people are sloppy or lazy, but because they can't get the financing to put a new roof.
That's true. And also, in many cities, the government specifically allowed zoning for polluting industries to go into black neighborhoods because white neighborhoods didn't want them. So that was another aspect of the neighborhood looking very bad.
So they literally draw a red line around that neighborhood.
They draw a red line, and I have maps that I show at my presentation, such as this one coming up at Printer's Row. I have the actual maps that were from 1940 that show that.
So is the residual effects of that still felt today? Are those the tougher neighborhoods in the city still?
You know, this is pretty much true throughout the country. Those neighborhoods that were redlined then are still highly segregated today. And I think if you want to look at the history of why we are so segregated, it's not just because some people like to say it's de facto segregation, meaning, well, blacks like to live with blacks and whites like to live with whites, but it's really a government-imposed policy.
Give me a neighborhood. What is a redlined neighborhood in Chicago?
Well, I would say, now, first of all, redlining was banned in 1968 with the Fair Housing Act, so that's 50 years ago. However, there's still residual effects of that, like a big study done by PBS NewsHour and Reveal found that white folks get loans for homes at three times the rate that blacks do with the same financial profile. So I can't say a neighborhood is redlined today because the policy doesn't exist anymore, but it would have been West Garfield Park, where I grew up. It would have been the South Side neighborhoods, you know, wherever a black person lived, for sure, that was redlined.
Right. Well, I mean, by definition.
Right.
Or certainly if it was a predominantly black neighborhood. So Inglewood today is probably a vestige of redlining.
It probably is, yes.
Austin may have been a redlined neighborhood.
Austin.
It depends on when, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely depends on when, because when I was ready to go to high school in 62, Austin High School was still about 94% white. I don't have the exact numbers, but over the period of time that those 4 years, I would have been at Austin had I been able to go there. I was my district was in Marshall High School, actually, and I heard your interview yesterday, which was very, very interesting. So I, you know, that probably would not have been redlined at the time when I was there.
Yeah. Were those public? Did the families, did the city know that the geography was portioned out into A, B, C, D, green to red neighborhoods?
I would think the powers that be would have to have known.
The bankers knew.
The bankers definitely knew, because the bankers were the ones who used these maps to be able to determine where they were going to give loans. And they simply said, no loans if there is a single African-American person in the community. And that was maybe not written down, but if you go on this mapping inequality, you can see the actual comments that the realtors or bankers made on the side. And they're quite shocking to look at today. I don't even think I'd want to say them on the air.
Give me a clue, though.
Well, they might say, for example, foreigners were also not welcome in many neighborhoods. So they might say Italians coming in. Or it might say threatened by Negro encroachment might be a neighborhood.
What do you make, though? So if you were a white neighbor, if you were in a predominantly white area, and African-Americans began to move into that neighborhood, and you describe some of these conversations where they would say, well, the coloreds are coming, I think. Mm-hmm. Was that the word?
The polite term of the time, which both blacks and whites used, was colored. For example, the National Association of Colored People.
Right.
People use that term as a polite term.
But if people put their life savings into it, you described how families would save for years and years and years to get that down payment. And it just seemed like wealth wasn't as profuse back then as it is now. So you can understand how people today, and certainly then, would really value the integrity of their neighborhood from a financial standpoint. If a person of color, an Italian or a black person, was moving into that neighborhood and they don't like that, it maybe doesn't, by today's definition, make them racist as much as realistic. Even if they embraced integration, they know that the value of their home is going to suffer.
Yes, that was a great fear among whites, that property values would suffer. And even Isabel Wilkerson, in her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, which is about the Great Migration, she points out that this was a reality. It was understood that property values would fall. And when she says, but not for the reasons that whites thought, that was the redlining that people didn't understand. They thought it was, they looked at the evidence, they see dilapidated homes, they say, we don't want blacks here. And plus, when they move in, our neighborhood is going to go down.
Well, it's two-pronged, as you point out also, because African-Americans were earning less, they still are, than whites.
Yes.
So it's not like you were going to self-finance that roof. You didn't make as much money. And even if you were employed, you weren't employed to the level that you might be able to get a loan that a white person would. Besides, you've been redlined, so forget about it. And it almost by design, then, black neighborhoods would disintegrate structurally.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true. And, the FHA, if people would build, let's say, a development that had 131 units, if one unit were sold to a black, the FHA wouldn't back those loans.
Really?
Yeah. You can read. My book is not meant to be a technical or, a book that is, it's definitely heavily researched, but it's not like something like Color of Law, an academic book.
No. In fact, so then what does your family have to do with all of this? That's the book.
The book is a lot about my family. My grandparents settled in West Garfield Park in 1912, and I sold my mom's two flat after she died in 1995. So we had a presence in West Garfield Park basically the entire 20th century. So what I was trying to do is tell the story of my parents and their devotion to property. My grandfather, as an immigrant, had been a janitor. And even though my father had a college education, he was just devoted to this kind of property care. So they had put a tremendous amount of personal effort. I mean, they didn't hire anything. Everything they did themselves, into beautifying their home and actually making it into a rooming house, which was really illegal. But they did it anyway. And so they were very invested in the neighborhood, Bethel Church, which out of which came Bethel New Life, if you know that community organization, was my family church at West End and Keeler. So the whole neighborhood, we were invested in the whole neighborhood. And then when the first African-American family moved on to our block in June of 1963, they didn't know quite what to do. My mom kept a diary of all this. That's what's really fascinating, is I have all these diaries and letters from the whole 20th century, thousands of pages upon which I've based this book.
Your parents were such great takers of journals. I mean, not just about real estate, too, by the way.
No.
About you, about each other. It's it's a treasure trove.
Yeah, it's a treasure trove. And it's these are primary documents of Chicago, living and Chicago history of one family. We're not famous, but the Newberry Library wants this entire collection because they say they've never seen anything like
it's so intimate, and it's not so super personal that it's not relevant to a larger audience. It's as I was reading the stuff that you were putting in the book, I thought this works both ways, doesn't it? It's an intimate portrayal, but it's also a bigger story. And that's what was surprising about this, reading your book. It's called Redlined. Let's pause for a second. You may have a question, comment, or observation. Redlined is Linda Gartz's book. It's a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. Speaking of LitFest, Linda Gartz is here. Her memoir is Redlined. It's a story of race, change, and a fractured community in the 1960s Chicago. If you're listening to us in Pennsylvania, you're going to love this book because more than anything, it's a personal narrative. You learn, though, about how communities get fractured and segregated. What's the takeaway, though? I mean, so it's fascinating to read about your family. Mental health issues, immigration issues, immigrant issues, personal betrayal issues. It's a great American family yarn. But what's the takeaway for all of us today in reading about your book?
Well, I think that, first of all, in terms of the redlined aspect, I want people to understand that this is why we're a segregated society.
That it was institutional.
That it was a government policy that created this segregation. It wasn't by accident. And that if we are going to solve this, we're going to have to be willing to accept to have people of color move into white neighborhoods. Maybe they might be Section 8, and people aren't too happy about that. So that's one thing, is to kind of try to break apart some of the segregation, which costs Chicago billions of dollars, according to the Metropolitan Planning Council. The other takeaway with the family is I want people to understand, I think in relationships and marriages, to really be vigilant, to understand what can be happening to their relationship that they may not even be aware of. You know, they're sometimes parents undermine children's relationships. Maybe they don't intend to, they just do.
Maybe you discover that mom didn't like the woman that the son picked out and preferred somebody else.
Yeah, right. Like in the World War II letters, I have 300 letters written to and from my uncle during World War II, and in them, my grandmother says to my uncle that she doesn't like my mother. She puts it, she says, Lil is only for herself. And I had never known that.
And this other girl is 1,000 times Lil.
Right.
Ooh, that's gotta hurt.
Yeah, and that was, her youngest son's girlfriend. And so she just wanted this other girl, I think as much as she wanted her son to be alive and for them to marry, she wanted this other girl for a daughter-in-law, and she was stuck with my mother, who married my dad, of course.
When you drive through some of the older neighborhoods of Chicago and see dilapidated blocks and you see these grand old homes, or you know they were there, what do you think when you see those?
You know, I have gone back to the old neighborhood several times. That's West Garfield Park. I've gone to a couple of church services at Bethel Lutheran Church, which is West End and Keeler. And I stop by and always look at my house, 4222, which is a beautiful...
West Washington.
4222 West Washington Boulevard. A couple blocks west of Pulaski. And, sometimes I've been tempted to buy it back and just redo it and live in it. I feel badly about it because it's been 50 years since the Martin Luther King riots after he was, so cruelly assassinated. So I gentrification is a hot topic, so I'm not even going to get into that. But however it would be, I would love to see these communities come back.
Read Redlined and then meet the author. She's going to be at LitFest on Saturday at 5 o'clock with Hermaine Hartman, who wrote Indigo Legacy. You both will be there Saturday at 5 at Jones College Prep. Is that where you're going to be doing that performance?
Yes, 700 South State.
You're also doing a book signing and reading, 57th Street Bookshop, June 24th at 3 p.m. That's a Sunday.
Yes, that's correct.
If folks want to follow you, how do they do that?
Well, I have a website, lindagartz.com, where they can learn tons more about redlining, the archives, about the book. There's videos, lots to learn, and all my events are posted there.
Good luck, Linda. Well done. Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for having me.
It's 2:31. Our news is next. And then, what's the latest with the volcanoes? There's no segue from one of those to the other, but we're going to catch up on that amazing story in a minute. Some of the TV stations in town have sent reporters to Colorado in anticipation of what may or may not happen. Either way, I guess that's the location for the story about Rod Blagojevich and whether or not he gets his sentence commuted. The president's staff is working on 30 petitions, and we understand that, in fact, Blagojevich's petition is one of them. They inherited it from the Obama administration when they first asked for clemency. That didn't happen. The paperwork, we were told that case was closed. Patty then goes on this full court press trying to get more attention to the president, and it appears that they are reconsidering their petition to get Rod out of jail early. Whatever you think about that, the method that they're using is ingenious, if nothing else. So we reached out to the Office of the Pardons. It's a Department of Justice office in Washington, D.C., and we said, hey, we're interested in someone explaining to us the role that the Office of the Pardon Attorney plays in petitions for clemency. Does your office have a position on a possible pardon for former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich? And they got back to me. And they said, hi, John. See, that automatically makes me think it's going to go well. It wasn't Dear Mr. Williams or something. It was, hi, John. Like, hey, how are you? That's how you tell me it's going to go well. We respectfully declined the interview.
Oh, God! That turned quick.
That close! I can confirm, however, the spokesperson said, that there is a pending petition for commutation for Rod Blagojevich with the Office for the Pardon Attorney. Please see Pardon Attorneys Frequently Asked Questions. Oh, I don't want to do that. Any schlub can do that. But I did. And here's what it says. It says that there's a number of criteria that they use. And I'll just touch on this so that if something happens, you will be maybe forearmed. It says on their very page, the pardon attorney routinely requests the United States attorney in the district of conviction in charge of the component to provide comments and recommendations. So the pardon attorney asks maybe Patrick Fitzgerald, what do you think? So they sort of assemble all of this information, all of this thought, and then they present their recommendation ultimately to the White House for action. The president does not have to abide by it, as I understand, but this is the purpose for this office. And they say the following are the principal factors taken into account. Number one, post-conviction conduct, character, and reputation. An individual's demonstrated ability to lead a responsible and productive life for a significant period after conviction or release from confinement. Blagojevich's will be fine. Seriousness and relative recentness of the offense. C is the one that caught my attention. Acceptance of responsibility, remorse, and atonement. The extent to which a petitioner has accepted responsibility for his or her criminal conduct and made restitution to its victims are important considerations. A petitioner should be genuinely desirous of forgiveness rather than vindication. Go back and read Rod's letter, his op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal last week. He is very much asking for vindication and very much not saying, I'm sorry, I did wrong. They say you should be genuinely desirous of forgiveness for a pardon or a commutation. While the absence of expressions of remorse should not preclude favorable consideration, a petitioner's attempt to minimize or rationalize culpability does not advance the case for pardon. Well, we'll see how it goes.
Now, do you think that him not dyeing his hair is part of the calculated?
Look at me.
I'm old. Get me out of here.
One of the reasons that they said they might also give you a favorable consideration is if your health is in decline.
No, but he looks good.
He does. I'm sure
prison did him well.
I think, you know, look, if you were confined, here's what I would do. I would read and write, and I would do abs. I would work on my abs.
Yeah.
What else have you got to do in jail?
The jet black hair, it wasn't doing him justice.
Oh, I'm sorry. You think he looks better in the gray-white that he has now?
Yeah, Silver Fox.
Oh, no. I think, okay, Around the Horn, LF Violetto. Which is the better look for Rod Blagojevich, the white hair or the dark hair, Violetta?
White hair, because the dark hair was jet black fake out of a box. Ella, it wasn't natural.
Go.
I agree. White hair.
I'm sorry for his white hair. I know that he thinks of himself as a dark hair. I think of him as a dark hair. Frankly, I'm not comfortable with Brian Urlacher having hair. I have in my image these people, and I know Brian likes hair. I don't think it's a good look for him. It's not Brian Urlacher. Similarly, Blagojevich is that dark wig, you know.
Wig-looking thing. You were going to say wig. No one wants that. He looks great with white hair. And it really makes his eyes pop. They're like blue.
You know, you're going for all the... Yesterday, you were pining for Bill Clinton. And today, you're all over Rod Blagojevich.
Rod's my people. We're both Serbian.
It's 2:44. Hey, have you been following the story about these volcanoes? It's not just in Hawaii now. It's other parts. I think there's like 30 active volcanoes on Earth. We've talked to Paul Stoddard, who is a geologist over at Northern Illinois University before, and I had a couple questions for him today. Hey, Paul, it's John Williams. You're back on the air. How are you?
Hey, John. How are you?
As you know, you're my favorite geologist at Northern Illinois University.
After that start, don't I have to decline the interview now?
No, you can still do the interview.
Oh, good.
Hey, are you surprised with what's happening on the Big Island, first of all?
Not terribly. You know, these things can go on for weeks, months, and I suppose even years. So,
but it seems to be getting worse. You know, like I thought, okay, this thing's going to pop. It's going to mow down some houses. It did 100 houses over the weekend, and it seems like the lava flow is getting more intense rather than backing off.
These things happen. You know, you build your house on a volcano. Unfortunately, this is sometimes the price you have to pay.
Is this significant enough that it will actually change the map of what that island looks like?
Well, actually, yes. I heard this morning that the lava had totally filled in a bay, so that's not going to be there anymore. So, you know, you wait a couple years, it's going to be some fresh real estate to build on. But... Of course, it's in a lava plain. However, it does. I mean, this is how the Big Island gets built, is eruption after eruption, and gradually the island grows and grows and grows until eventually the Pacific Plate moves it off of the hot spot, and then erosion will start taking over, and a new island will pop up someplace.
Pretty soon, dirt and plants and things, and the next thing you know, that'll look like it was there all along, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, if you go to any of the other Hawaiian islands, they're all extinct volcanoes, and they're all very green and lush.
What about this Guatemala thing? Is that where it is? That one that just went kapow, shot dust, ash, and rock 47,000 right. feet into the air?
Yeah, so that's, what we have are two different types of volcanoes going off. So the Hawaiian volcano is over a hot spot, and so it gets a basaltic lava, and that gives you that type of eruption. The Guatemala volcano is over a subduction zone where a plate is subducting underneath Central America. And that gives you a more andesitic magma, which gives you much more explosive eruptions, eruptions that have a lot more ash and other things like that associated with it. And those tend to be much more deadly. Because they happen very quickly, they're very explosive.
Right.
The lava ones will wipe out subdivisions, obviously, but usually people have plenty of time to get out of the way of the lava itself.
Well, are these related at all?
Well, they're both on Earth. But other than that...
look at that! A geologist cracking wise. Who knew?
It happens.
So they're not related, are they?
Not really, no.
Yeah. I'd like to think that it's like, holy cow, there's going to be one in your home state. Boom, 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 boom. It's like the chicken heart, that all of a sudden we're having a rash of volcanoes. Would you describe that we're having a rash of volcanic eruptions?
No, what's unusual is that they're taking place in populated areas. So, I mean, there are volcanoes all around the Pacific Ocean. You know, the so-called Ring of Fire goes all the way from Chile up through Central America, the San Andreas Fault, the Cascade Volcanoes. The Aleutian Islands are all volcanic, Japan, the Philippines, down to New Zealand. These are all volcanic regions. And to have a couple of volcanoes going off at the same time,
yeah,
really not very unusual.
Hey, what do you think of Yellowstone? Any chance that thing's going to blow up? I was reading in a book today, and it said that there's a whole bunch of hot magma below Yellowstone that's the size and almost shape of New Hampshire. And it goes like 50,000 feet down. It's just a bunch of hot magma there, and that thing could go kablooey at any time, too. What do you think of that?
Right. So Yellowstone is also over a hot spot, like Hawaii is.
Yeah.
The difference is that we have a continent instead of an ocean there. So that the surface expression of these is a little different.
I understand that, but I mean, think about that. So it happens in the ocean, kapow, you get that. But this thing that's under Yellowstone is bigger, and the fact that it's under a continent doesn't mean that it couldn't go kapow, right?
Oh, it certainly could go kapow. I think there'll be a fair amount of warning before it does.
Really? Would it be more like what happened in Hawaii, or would it be more like what's happening in Guatemala?
Oh, when it goes, I suspect it'll be a lot more like Guatemala.
How much warning will we have?
Well, you know, since we haven't actually seen this, Yellowstone's what we call a super volcano. So, I mean, it's much, much larger than the things going on down in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
So if it exploded as a super volcano, you know, that would be very bad. And even out here, we would not be safe.
But it is gone. It's blown up several hundred. It's blown up over 100 times over the course of millennia. And,
right.
If it was going to happen, would we get a week's notice, a month's notice, a year's notice?
Well, since the last time it happened, nobody was around to monitor it.
Yeah.
We don't know for certain what type of things will happen. But, you know, usually these things are associated with magma moving. It's not just that it's down there, but it's actually beginning to move up into places. And that gives us specific types of earthquakes,
right,
called harmonic tremors. And so we can, Mount St. Helens, we saw a lot of these before it went. Now, Yellowstone will be much larger. Mount St. Helens, we had a few weeks, couple of months notice. Yellowstone, I would expect we would have at least that much.
I'm trying to sow the seeds of terror here in our listeners. This is Talk Radio. I'd appreciate your help on this, if you don't mind, Professor.
Oh, sure. Well, when the thing goes, you know, everything's going to just be buried in ash, and you know, it's going to be death, destruction, as far as the eye can see.
That's all I'm at. Was that painful? Okay.
That was kind of fun.
I need to talk to you again. In a week or so, let's just continue to, more seriously, if you will, follow what's happening in these two cases. Obviously, we're interested in what's happening in Hawaii, but what's happening in Guatemala is more explosive and unfortunately deadly. I'm going to call you again in the next week or so, and we'll continue to follow it. We appreciate your expertise.
Terrific.
Paul Stoddard is at Northern Illinois University. He's a geologist there. We're in the Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue, which means I can turn on this microphone and say hello to, who are you?
Bob and Rochelle.
Bob and Rochelle. What are you doing out there?
We came to see you as you're still in the Showcase Studio.
Where are you from?
Cuba, Illinois.
It's near my old stomping grounds,
yep,
of Peoria.
It is.
Yep.
So you came to Chicago to
well,
see us.
Last week, we Paul Simon concert happens to be tonight, and we're going to that.
Ah.
And so we dovetailed real well to come and see you. We saw Bill and Wendy earlier.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, you're our two favorite shows. We listen every day.
Oh, I so appreciate
that. Or podcast.
We followed you all the way through Minnesota.
And listened to you while you were there.
Oh, no kidding. And now we're back here. And now we're leaving this studio. You can't come and wave anymore.
Well, that's why we wanted to do it this week. Well, you know, going over there, right?
You picked a nice time to be in Chicago.
Yeah.
What a pretty day.
It is a nice day. A little cool yesterday.
I know, actually.
We also wanted to say hi to Violetta and Ella.
We're all here.
They add a whole lot to the show. And
don't they, though?
Well,
yeah.
So does Steve, of course.
I mean,
Steve adds a lot to whatever he does.
Any show that Steve Bertrand touches is a better show.
Exactly
we
right.
We say that exactly.
Exactly right, yeah.
Well, how nice of you guys to make the effort.
Yeah, well, Thank you for all your years.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Well, I'm not going anywhere. We're still going to be here, but it'll be in that building over there.
Your show
is so entertaining because you're articulate, intelligent, open to ideas, and that's kind of unusual in the world today.
How much did you pay this guy?
I know. I should have gone to them a lot earlier, Violetta. I don't know why I waited.
Hey, we like you too, Violetta.
Yeah. Okay, keep going. Leave him on all day.
I kind of wanted to see you because I got an image of what you look like.
I'll tell you what. I'm about to sign off here. I'll come out and say hi. Stay there, okay?
Cool. Thanks.
Rokan, Anna DeVlantis in the studio.
Hi there, John.
It's a real pleasure to be with you guys. I'm going to go see those people from Cuba, Illinois. What's the matter, Ro? Ro?
I'm having an email that has just been sent to me here that is of incredible importance.
Does it involve the move to the other building?
It involves my dinner reservation.
I'm
here. I'm fully here. I'm sorry.
I think it's interesting.
So
you mentioned there are some longtime GN listeners outside the Streetside studio here just to sort of be here for the last few shows in the Tribune Tower, and that's super cool.
We should never take for granted the people on the other side of the, you know, speakers.
Right. That's right.
And when we get to meet you, it's almost always a thrill. Some of you are scary and disappointing.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that.
What are you talking about? That has never happened.
Well, the Streetside Studio sort of has invited people who might be scarier than the normal individual to make themselves known.
Oh, let's do this.
Let me just say that I would say that that many listeners have said the exact same thing about us.
Oh, no,
we met them and they're scary and disappointing.
Which is a reason we're in radio. Okay, so let's all do this. You guys come in early one day, and we'll do our Tales from the Showcase studio.
Oh.
Scary stuff. Oh, that would be fun.
Because I've got stories. I think I have the best stories.
You've been in the Showcase studio for the better part of 25 years, right?
You must have seen a lot.
Oh, my God. I'm going to give you my top 10 things I've seen out the Showcase studio window.
And did you just get very good at blocking it out over time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine.
Yes. I have two. I've only been here 3 years, but I have two good ones.
Yeah. You do.
I do.
I can think of one really good one.
I have two pretty good ones right now. And it's always in the winter when it gets dark. People think it's night, even though it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
They think it's okay now.
Yeah. It's time to come out now.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so let's pick a date next week. Because we're only in here for two more weeks. Let's pick a day next week.
I like
you guys stroll in here 15 minutes early. We'll kick it around. Have a good show, kids.